Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Through the 20th century, Ireland had a notoriously strict censorship regime when it came to movies. While famous titles like The Life of Brian or The Exorcist were censored in one way or another, at one point, around one in every three films were being censored in Ireland. The reasons why are hard to fathom today. Scenes that showed a dancer's legs or even a long kiss were often edited out. Conversations or even allusions to sex were often considered far too racy as well. And this was all before they even got to films that strayed into the world of politics or religion. Now, this podcast is a fascinating exploration of what seems today to be a very strange world of film censorship in Ireland. We look at how, and perhaps more importantly, why so many movies were cut in Ireland. Hello and welcome to the Irish History Podcast. My name is Finn Dwyer. Now in today's episode, I'm joined by Aoife Brannock and Lloyd Maeve Houston. While both my guests have featured on previous episodes, they've since joined forces to produce a series of Aoife's podcast censored on banned or clipped movies. I've links to that in the show notes below. You'll really want to check it out after listening to today's show. Now, we had a great time recording this conversation. There's going to be so many of those moments where you'll find it hard to even fathom that this was happening in Ireland just a few decades ago. It seems at times like a different planet. Sound on today's show was by Kate Dunlea. Now, to begin our conversation, I wanted to get a bit of a background on film censorship. It is comparatively new, since cinema itself really only dates from the early 20th century. However, Aoife explained how an 1857 law that targeted porn and seditious political tracts would be very influential when it came to film censorship. Passed by the Parliament of the United Kingdom, this applied to Ireland, given the entire island was in the UK at the time, and as I say, it would be very influential going forward.
Printers were publishing really quite filthy material. I mean, it's porn, but they're also publishing what is considered seditious material. So politically controversial opinions, birth control information. In the 1820s, birth control information isn't really seen as just a factual matter, but a much bigger question of how the state regulates itself and how people should regulate their fertility. So that particular blurred line between publishers who like to publish something like The Lustful Turk, which is just a pornographic text, and then birth control material, they're targeted under the same sorts of libel laws for those materials. But the Obscene Publications Act is an attempt to really tighten up that system and to make it even more difficult for publishers to produce seditious or dirty material.
Okay, so to lay some groundwork for film censorship, I asked Aoife to skip forward a bit and explain what happened in 1922 when the Irish Free State was established. 26 counties left the United Kingdom and had to devise new methods of governance and censorship. Like in many areas, they would rely heavily on the old British framework, although this was tweaked and refined.
It's not really a departure. It's more a change in the mechanism of censorship. So the concepts of obscenity and indecency are still swirling around, borrowed from that system. So what the Irish do is then centralize the system and create centralized censorship. So rather than through the courts, magistrates, or local authorities, they create, in the case of publications, a board in 1929, but in the case of film, one man becomes the film censor and everything is funneled through him. So it's really using the same conceptual framework within the legal tradition, but making one man the focus and the agent of censorship. So it's a very centralized system, which is, you know, something the new state likes to do. It does a lot of centralization, and this is one manifestation of it.
The situation in Northern Ireland was different. The six counties there remained in the United Kingdom, and Lloyd now explains how they retained the British model, but also how the authorities would take it to extremes. Lloyd began by explaining the British system in more detail.
Cinema censorship in Britain and the six counties that go on to become Northern Ireland is regulated by a 1909 Film Licensing Act, the Cinematograph Act, which principally was concerned with making sure people didn't burn to death in cinemas. Film stock in this period is highly flammable. It's made from kind of cellulose and silver and things, and it runs through very hot projectors that are usually kind of lit by burning lime. You combine that with a very small space because they're usually just, you know, screened in little kind of back rooms and things. You've got a recipe for disaster. Now, in establishing that licensing regime in the interest of public safety, there's space left for local authorities to kind of make their own provisions in terms of what kinds of films are shown to what kinds of audience and so on. This is sort of strategically ambiguous. This leads to a situation in which there are increasing calls for a kind of homogenous system or a kind of more explicit moral regulation of cinema. And so the cinema industry, particularly distributors, become quite anxious about this and what that might do to their business if the state becomes involved in regulating film. And so in a manner similar to what happens in America with the establishment of the what goes on to be the MPA, you have the establishment of the BBFC, which is the British Board of Film Censors and eventually Classification, which is established in 1912. It's important to note that that's a non-state body, right? It's notionally independent of the state. In reality, it liaises very closely with the Home Office quite often. It sort of suits the British government that it's not, quote unquote, a state censorship. It suits the industry to kind of check that the Home Office won't intervene to kind of countermand any decisions they make. So one hand kind of washes the other. And so that kind of governs the regime in the north of Ireland from its inception.
Now, this system left a huge amount of power with local authorities in the north. While the BBFC, the British Board of Film Censors, passed its judgments, local bodies in Northern Ireland frequently banned films that were permitted in Britain.
What that means is that you've got this sort of consistent push and pull between what the BBFC say is fine and what people in the north of Ireland think is fine. You know, if the South, you know, the kind of popular conception of censorship is synonymous with a kind of puritanical Catholicism, in the North, it's kind of Protestant and particularly, you know, kind of Presbyterian equivalent is to the fore. What that means is that you get bodies like the Film Committee of the Churches in Northern Ireland. It won't surprise you that the churches in question don't include the Catholic Church, but that's established in 1930 and which puts pressure on the Belfast Corporation to kind of make film censorship more stringent. You arrive at a kind of bizarre situation, or, you know, perhaps kind of surreal situation, given the relationship between the two states otherwise, where you've got a lot of religious bodies in the north of Ireland being like, nah, the South really, like, they've nailed this censorship thing. We need a state censor. We need one person really on this. But what you basically have are what Shan Barber, who's based at QUB, has done some good research on this. What she sort of describes as a kind of hyper regionalism or sort of hyper localism, where, you know, depending on who is most vocal and angry in a particular area, you can kind of, you know, town to town, you could see different things sort of be available. So part of what comes to determine what people can view is just how far they're prepared to travel or if they're prepared to travel.
Overall, the censorship regime in the North was severe. The movie Frankenstein was banned, for example, even after the British Board of Film Censors had passed it. The issue there was that it depicted a man playing God, since Dr. Frankenstein created a monster. This gives you a sense of how stringent censorship could be.
Frankenstein gets passed by the BBFC, the 1932 Universal Pictures one. A lot of local authorities in the north of Ireland kick up a fuss about it because they, you know, see it as a film in which man assumes the kind of mantle of God and, you know, creating life. Kind of missing the point of the story. It's not, you know, it's not a film that endorses that activity, but even the mere fact of it is, you know, no, that's beyond the pale. Although you can't see it in Belfast, you can go see it in Strabane. So, you know, it's inconsistent in that way.
Given what we've heard so far, it'll come as no surprise that politics was an extremely sensitive subject. Censors in Northern Ireland, who were exclusively unionist, frowned on any semblance of sympathy for the Republican movement. Lloyd now explains just how paranoid this could be.
There's another film, Ourselves Alone, which, as you can possibly hear from its title, you know, wouldn't play well for an Ulster audience, even though actually it's a film that is very much kind of saying, you know, Jesus, the British troops had it hard. They were the real, they really have the true claim on the phrase ourselves alone in the War of Independence. But just under a rubric of public order, just alluding to that violence and that period of violence is seen to be sort of beyond the pale. There's an irony in that these films that otherwise might have been fairly kind of benign or sparked off some, you know, local kind of unrest, by being banned, are then elevated to the status of something that demands attention and becomes controversial.
We went on to talk about censorship in the Free State, the 26 counties that went on to become the Republic of Ireland. Lloyd explained some of the views that shaped censorship and how the censors almost viewed cinema itself as subversive.
Kevin Rockett, who, you know, has quite literally sort of written the book on Irish cinema censorship, talks about how it's partly emerges out of the clash of two popular cultures that the state is trying to sort of cultivate or regulate, right? You have the sort of rural popular culture that cultural nationalism had sought to sort of sponsor and fetishize and reify in the kind of state. And then you have a secular, modern, commercialized, gaudy in the eyes of, you know, someone like the first sort of Irish film censor, popular culture of the United States and Britain. And so in the same way that, you know, you have Douglas Hyde talking about the vulgar trash of English weeklies, you know, coming in, contaminating the Irish mind in a kind of print context, there's a sort of resuscitation of that mindset. But now it's, you know, American, you know, racy women in their fast cars with their fancy, you know, outfits and so on. That's the big bugbear. And you get to watch all of this in a warm place with plush seats where you know, you might wind up brushing up against other people. So yeah, the whole thing is charged with a sort of frisson of pleasure and license in a way that puritanical state takes issue with.
A lot of different film genres were censored in the Free State. As you might expect, anything relating to sex could fall foul of the censor. Even the image of a scantily clad woman was a major no-no.
So there's talk of not wanting there to be any kind of naval displays in Ireland, or, you know, kind of exposed limbs and scenes of dancing and so on come in for sort of criticism. A lot of this is basically the censor kind of accurately responding to the ways in which particularly kind of Hollywood cinema uses in this period certain kind of scenarios to import in slightly racier material. So, you know, rather than kind of directly staging a, you know, kind of romantic scene or a striptease or something, you kind of evoke it kind of metonymically or have it, you know, play out. Like, there's one of the films that we've, Eve and I've sort of talked about in, is It, which is a 1927 film starring Clara Bow that gives rise to the sort of figure of the It girl and is part of this whole, you know, kind of campaign of self-publicity by a woman called Eleanor Glynn, who's a very interesting figure in sort of establishing what kind of sex appeal is in the popular imagination in the sort of 10s and 20s. But, you know, with that, you've got our kind of It girl variously altering a dress to kind of make it more racy, cutting out sections of it, or, you know, going on a kind of helter-skelter thing at a fun fair in a manner that just fortuitously happens to, you know, kind of blow up her skirt, or through a series of intensely implausible events, winding up having been plunged into water and then clinging on to the anchor of a boat.
Next, Aoife explains how far this could go. She did this by talking about a Mae West film, I'm No Angel, that was banned. Now, Mae West was a major star in the 30s, and this film was frowned on because it depicted a sexually independent woman, something that would have sent 1930s Ireland into meltdown. Aoife explains one particularly controversial aspect of the film here and gives you a sense about why it was banned.
The best part of the film plays out with Mae West's character basically brazening her way through a court case in which people question her virtue and her modesty, and she shrugs and more or less says, "So, it was good fun," and everyone laughs. So this ostensible fallen woman, you know, challenges the whole system of judgment around her sexual behavior, and the male who, you know, rejected her is like, "Yeah, okay, it's fine, it doesn't matter." It's absolutely insane to imagine Irish people watching this. But of course, in the South, they weren't watching this.
While that movie was banned, there were lots of other types of films that were edited or banned entirely. Lloyd now explains how depictions of Jesus Christ were potentially blasphemous.
So Irish censorship and British censorship both have kind of hang-ups around what's termed the materialization of Christ. So kind of depicting, you know, Jesus as a character in a kind of film drama is a bit of a problem. Partly, you know, I mean, in the British context, I suppose that is bound up with, you know, a broad Protestant tradition's kind of anxieties about, you know, iconography and idolatry around, you know, depictions of Christ. But it might seem stranger in a Catholic culture, or broadly, you know, a Catholic culture, to worry about materializing Christ in that way. Again, from what kind of traces we have of various censors' thoughts on this matter, a big anxiety there is just that the cinema is seen as a low form of entertainment and a kind of low place morally. And so the idea of, you know, the savior being depicted on the same screen on which you've just watched a dripping wet Clara Bow, you know, or where, you know, the idea of, there's a very funny kind of sequence in the debates when the Censorship Act is initially being passed, where one kind of particularly fastidious TD sort of talks about how, you know, he'd went to see a film adaptation of Dante's Inferno and was kind of horrified to watch, you know, an audience kind of booing the devil and cheering for, you know, the kind of whenever particularly sort of impressive, you know, magical feats were occurring. So I think there's an anxiety that the same spirit will be brought to, you know, the activities of the savior, you know, when will people break into applause when water becomes wine, or, you know, what's his next trick?
When it came to politics, censors in the Free State were every bit as paranoid as their northern counterparts, although for different reasons.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much. But when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And UnitedHealthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
The other kind of consideration that, again, might seem slightly odd to us, but again, fits with broad patterns of how censorship, particularly sort of stage censorship, had worked in the UK, is also depictions of like foreign heads of state and depictions of foreign governments. So there's a kind of reticence about presenting almost kind of any, you know, foreign political figures for fear that it might, you know, somehow kind of taint relations with that government. This gets really crazy during the Second World War when it becomes all but impossible to kind of depict seemingly anything that's happening in that conflict in a way that means that our cinema in the Republic of Ireland just kind of refer to an outside world almost, or has to do so in sort of strange and oblique ways.
I wanted to know more about the practicalities of this censorship. Aoife's answer here is fascinating. This was all in an age before digital editing, so it was done by hand. But she also explains how the censor turned into a movie editor of a kind. This could see him cut out long kisses or scenes with chorus girls' legs, for example.
So in Dublin, the film censor is paid per foot of film by the distributors to censor. And what censorship means is banning or certifying or cutting. So certification was just a general certificate for everybody. So the problem in the Free State and the Republic was that certs were not distinguishing between different audiences. So you have a general cert for everybody and that's it. So there's no such thing as a certification for adult audiences or anything like that. And as a result, the censor demands a huge amounts of cuts from a lot of films. If he can't ban a film or feels that it could be tidied up, he will suggest cuts. And in his reports, he kept these books. They're in the National Archives. And you know, each film has a page. So he puts down the name of the film, the director, the stars, its reference number within their system, and also its length. So its length in feet. And he talks about, you know, should cut this scene here if you cut this. So he does make very specific suggestions for removing chorus girls' legs. He really doesn't like the can-canning chorus girl that is such a feature of films up until the 60s. You know, there's a lot of music and dance in film. And these interlude scenes, which are, as Lloyd pointed out, with the It Girls, they are also an opportunity to get the women undressed or in slinky outfits or let their hair down. They are, you know, an excuse as much as entertainment or art. So he often demands cuts of legs, cuts of a lot of snogging. If there's a very long clinch, which is fairly typical of these films, there's long drawn out kisses. He thinks like, really, you know, can we make it a 2 second number, please? Because he finds that it's just grotesque. And one of his favorite words is vulgar. You know, he thinks that things are somehow like cheap and nasty, which ties into what Lloyd said earlier about the anxieties around this as a common low form of entertainment. So, yes, he does demand cuts. And in that way, he's sort of following on with, you know, the Hays Code in Hollywood with the film producers who are submitting their scripts before production. And so they are cut at that stage as well. So throughout the film production process, there are excisions happening at loads of different levels. And the Irish censor is like the last one that when the film actually reaches him before it gets to the audience in the Free State.
Now, the amount of editing that was going on is mind-boggling. Aoife explains just how common and extensive it was.
Well, there were so many films that were cut. In many ways, it was about 30% of the films, approximately, end up cut in some form or another. Now, as to how severe that varies from film to film. You know, sometimes it would be a frame or two. Sometimes it would be, you know, 20 minutes could be cut out of a film. Or, you know, during the war in particular, there was so much censorship associated with the emergency that films were really severely cut because they were trying to disguise war activity in a film. So if it showed airplanes with insignia on it, that would be cut. So it really varies. You know, it's just over time, it adds up to huge amounts. But every film is a very individual case because the way that the censor watched every film was very close. and was very judgmental. So for some films, it'd be cutting a couple of foot, and for other films, it could be cutting up to 20 feet.
This left me wondering if the audience were bewildered. I asked Aoife, were people not really confused by films that were censored? She now explains how some people just thought they hadn't understood the film, or some people might have been otherwise engaged in the cinema.
People didn't talk about it much, but there are references, occasionally glancing references, where people are like, we've all complained about the strange decisions in the cutting. So sometimes it was obvious. There are jumps that were obvious, say, with The Graduate. The Graduate was cut in the 70s because there was a scene in a church and it showed the crucifix and it was in the church. And that was apparently blasphemous because that's one of the criteria. So that was cut. But as a result, it's a link scene in the film. So suddenly people are running down a path, you know, having gone from inside to outside. And people thought, how have they gone from A to B? And I actually did ask somebody recently, she's in her 70s. And I said, do you remember like cuts? Do you remember thinking there was something strange? She said, I used to think, I don't understand. I don't get this bit. And it was just, I just don't get this. But that's such a fleeting moment. You would often blame yourself. You'd be like, maybe I wasn't paying attention. Maybe I was, in fact, trying to brush up against the person next to me in the film, in the cinema, or I was on a date, or, you know, so sometimes, yes, the cuts were obvious, but sometimes the cuts demanded were so severe that the distributors refused to make them and wouldn't actually submit the cut film. They were like, there's just no point. There'll be nothing left. It won't make any sense. And I suppose they were thinking also of the product that they are producing. You know, if the film is going to be unwatchable, that affects people's perceptions of stars and their market value in the future. So there's perhaps that going on as well.
So myself, Aoife and Lloyd have only touched on the bizarre world of movie censorship in Ireland in this conversation. Now, as I mentioned at the top of the show, Aoife and Lloyd have teamed up to make an entire series that looks at various movies that were censored. When I ask them about it, you get a real sense of the fun that series is.
I've been making Censored about banned books and magazines for a while now, and it's been great fun. But I really wanted to broaden the discussion about censorship. And also, I did feel that like Lloyd was one of the few people who absolutely appreciated the weirdness, the fascination, and the madness of censorship. And it is nice, you know, to have someone to share your obsessions with. So I thought Lloyd would be a pretty good choice on that front.
Yeah, if misery loves company, so does kind of filthy mindedness, I guess. And well, you know, if one wants to hear about how the filthy minded of Ireland, you know, shared each other's company, we've got an episode where Aoife does this kind of fantastic deep dive into a kind of ring of illicit cinema screening operating in the Dublin area. It's the nearest we get to kind of going true crime, although we try to be sort of, you know, circumspect and ethical in how we approach that. And, you know, all parties are duly anonymized, and it's a story that goes in some quite harrowing directions in terms of how the state treats some of the people involved. But yeah, no, I mean, it's been a joy to be tapped into it. You know, yeah, I think partly it's just born out of how much of a giggle it is to talk this stuff over with Aoife.
I'd like to thank Aoife and Lloyd for their time. I'd really recommend checking out that series of Censored. I've links to it in the show notes below. It takes a deep dive into some of the movies we've talked about. Now, next week, I'll be back with a new show. Until then, Sloan.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince? They exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing.
Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.